and that you don't walk in front of her like you were asked to. All right, it brings me great pleasure to introduce our speaker tonight, Trish.
That is beautiful. And it's really it's a privilege and an opportunity to be your speaker, and I thank Christian and whoever was involved in getting me up here. I am Trish and I'm an alcoholic. Do you have any other alcoholics in the room? Thank God I'm home. My sobriety date is March 15th, 1973. That means I got 37 years of sobriety, and I am so glad about my sobriety. I'm working on my 38th year now, a day at a time. I'm going to tell you a little bit about my family, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. I didn't come from an alcoholic family. It was wasn't until I was about a teenager or so that I saw that my dad drank straight whiskey. And I never saw my mother drink, but a little bit later, a few years later than that, I seen a bottle of Seagram 7 in the trunk of my mother's car. I wondered why she was going out to the trunk. But they never crossed in over the line into alcoholism, and I'm so glad because if they was anything like their daughter was, you know, she was hell on wheels. And I am one of two daughters, and my twin, I've never seen her. I'd seen her turn around and put just a little bit in eggnog, whatever they was drinking, just a itty bit. She took a sip and she left it alone. Mm-hmm. Not me. I'm the kind of drunk, I pick it up, and there's no guarantees where it's going to take me. I could care less. And what I was going to do, it is about, I guess it was about somewhere in the early 60s. I wasn't old enough to buy alcohol. And they had a fleet of Navy guys in Long Beach. And I would go to the liquor store, and I'd see one of those Navy guys heading up to the liquor store. I'd call him on the side, and I says, would you buy me a six-pack? And they did, you know. And so that was the beginning of I needed more. I wanted more. And I dabbled into drugs just a little bit. I'm glad that I didn't get way off into it. If I would have got off into it any more than I did, I probably wouldn't be standing in front of here. I'd probably be in a sane asylum. Because I was looking for the effects produced by something. And as a kid, I thought, well, you know, sniffing gas might be a way to get high. And I tried it, but thank God I didn't try it for a long time. That's why I'm not in a loony bin. So here's what happens when I took the first drink. Magic. And so what I'm trying to do is to recapture the magic that I found in the first drink. And what I was to realize was it was the first sippy poo that started that physical and mental obsession that was going to carry me to the bitter end, all the way into degradation and demoralization. Now, there was a time when I first started drinking, I could go to a bar and I didn't drink nothing. But, you know, they just wasn't doing it fast enough for me. So I'd get me half a pint of something. I'd have in a car and I'd take a couple of swigs off of that, and then I'd go in and I'd happy. And then it didn't bother me so much. But it got to bother me more because I was wondering why they didn't want to come up and ask me if I wanted more. You know, I was trying to be respectful of the barmaid, you know, they're supposed to come and ask you and so forth. Now here I am, I'm sitting in a bar and I need to go to the bathroom. And I finally made it up and I stood up against the wall like this. And I thought, oh my God, how am I going to get to the ladies' room? Mm-hmm. And so I staggered my way to the restroom. I can't turn around and tell you what happened after that because I was a blackout drinker. And it always took more every time I drank. And I started out with a quart wall of beers. And before I knew it, a police officer tapped me on the shoulder. Yes. Come on, you're going with us. I said, why? Well, they busted me for arson. So before I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I was going to have two felonies on my record, not to mention all the other counts that they had against me. And then I started getting 86 out of bars. I wasn't a nice drunk. When I drank whiskey, bourbon, or something like that, the hard stuff, it seemed like it was pretty mellow. But when I drank beer, I got real nasty. You know, and I got a disposition inside me, right? And I'm just pounding down the alcohol. And somebody looks at me just a little bit off. And there goes whatever I'm drinking. Right towards you. And so before I got 86 out of this bar, when I walked in the bar, it was a parting of the Red Sea. They didn't know what this guy was going to do. And one particular night, I had picked up a pool play, and I'm sitting back there, and I'm going to play some pools. I got my 50 cents. I put it on the table over here. This guy, probably maybe about Steve's size, he turned around and he took my 50 cents and he put it in there and slid it, brought the balls out, he put them on the table. Meanwhile, my legs are moving toward him. And I said to him, I said, that's my 50 cents. I said, I'm not Nick. He said, you can play when I'm finished. So I took the balls and I scattered them all over and I said, you're finished. No wonder I didn't get my head knocked off. So I went from quart bottle of beer to malt liquor. And then I changed from malt liquor to whiskey, bourbon, Hill and Hill, you name it. And I came to the point where I started hiding my alcohol. I would drink coffee royals. It was during the day. I would have some whiskey with orange juice or grapefruit juice, anything to hide the alcohol. Here I am. I'm sobered up. Finally got into Alcoholics Anonymous. And I went across the street over to my neighbors and I said, hey, guess what? I'm going to Alcoholics Anonymous. She says, Trish, why are you going to Alcoholics Anonymous? She said, you don't have a drinking problem. You come over at my house and maybe you had one or two beers. And my response was, I didn't tell you how much I drank before or after. But somewhere down inside, there was a little bit of pride, a little bit of good pride in me. And the only way that I was able to turn around and get that was to be sick and tired of being sick and tired. Mm. Now, I had a bottle in the car. I still have a bottle a day, but I drink something different. And I lost my train of thought. Anyway. I better hear him talk. I'm on the mic here.
Yeah, I always had a bottle in the car.
I always had a bottle in the car. Very good. I always had a bottle in the car. And you know what? That is neat. We got people in Alcoholics Anonymous going to help you along the way, no matter what kind of time you have. So here I am. What was I at?
Your neighbor.
No.
Your neighbor didn't?
No, where? All right.
You should be in the, you always had a ball in your car. You've been to Alcoholics Anonymous.
Okay. All right. I know where I'm at. I'm just figuring if you guys are listening. I want you to hear every word that I say. Because you can't blame me, because everything I'm telling you I have learned from other people in Alcoholics Anonymous. Where I left off was, I always had a bottle in the car. And police officer would pull me over and I said, "Ma'am, would you get out of the car?" "Yes, sir." "I'm going to give you a sobriety test." "Okay." So I start doing the walk, you know. And I'm not doing so good. And I said, "Excuse me, police officer. Would you please let me do this on the sidewalk, because this road is not flat?" He says, "Yes, ma'am." We went to the sidewalk and I tried it, and of course. I got thrown in jail one more time. And where did they put a person like me? In a drunk tank. You know, they put me in there, and then that steel door would just slam. And I still can picture that sound, because I was to go there many a time. I'm sure Lakewood, Long Beach, Gardena, Los Angeles, and a few other towns are glad that I made it in Alcoholics Anonymous. And along the way, people just tried to tell me that I had a problem with booze. Like, "Don't you think you're an alcoholic? You bought 2 6-packs of beer and put in the fridge." And so I remedied that by not putting nothing in the refrigerator. The matrons, when I get sold to jail for being drunk, "Don't you think you might have a problem with alcohol?" But you know, it just went way over my head. And so, I did have some fun in jail. It wasn't prison, it was jail. A couple of my friends would end up in jail the same time I did. And I was wearing a green uniform, and we just got through eating beans and cornbread. Mm-hmm. And so one of the gals decided to have a little bit of fun. So she took some of her garbage and just threw it at us. And then I thought, "Well, you know what? There's a garbage can right here, Trish. All you have to do is reach down inside of it." And I got a plate full of garbage and I threw it at her. And about this time, somebody's going to think on us, right? And they did. And we hurried up and was wiping down walls and everything. And got some more uniforms on to act as if. See, the reason I'm telling you all this is because when I picked up the drink, the first drink, the ability for me to care wasn't there. Alcohol is a depressant. It's a destroyer. It's a disease that turns around and tells us we don't have it. Mm-hmm. It's cunning, baffling, and powerful. It's so powerful. I've seen through all the years that I've been sober, a lot of people where alcohol has turned around and took them out. Took them down. And I've seen miracles come in the room through Alcoholics Anonymous too. One guy that used to come here, I used his name because he's dead now, his name's Don. Mm-hmm. He did a prison term. Came in here, come to Alcoholics Anonymous, in about 2 weeks before he's going to hit 5 years of continuous sobriety, another member saw him sitting on a curb, and the member sat down and talked to him, tried to coach him back to come back to the program. Because see, what they had found was a way to learn to live, and they wanted this man to find it too. And then we heard that he had committed suicide, or he died from overdose. Not everybody stays, not everybody's going to make it, so you're going to have to try real hard to stay. It's going to take everything that you can muster up in order to stay, especially in the beginning. Because the obsession to drink and my mind would not shut off when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I was always thinking about drinking. And how I got into Alcoholics Anonymous was is that there was a gal named Fran and Sean. And Fran was going to an AA meeting. And she was going to celebrate her 5 years of continuous sobriety. Well, see, I didn't know that. They asked me if I wanted to go to a party. Well, of course I wanted to go to a party. And I asked her, I said, Fran, how old are you? She says, 5. And I said, well, I don't touch up with a 10-foot pole. And when I sat in that first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I panned around the room and I saw a light in everybody's eyes. And I knew that there was none in mine. I intuitively knew there was none in mine. I could not have described to you, maybe in the first couple of years of my sobriety, what I felt like when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. And what I felt like was that the light was on and nobody was home. And they'd turn around and say things like, let us love you until you can learn to love yourself. And you know, that was music to my ears. But see, I hadn't found out yet that I didn't love Trish. And when I was out there drinking, I ran with some wild people. I rode with the Hells Angels for a while. I was a alley gal, carried chains, and if you looked at me like the person in the bar, it would be wrapped around your neck. And that's somewhat of who I'd become. And when I got into Alcoholics Anonymous and that change began, I wanted to learn to turn around and do it different. And then you'd say things like, keep coming back, just like over that door. Please read that sign every time that you leave. Because what that sign is saying is, you bring your feet and the mind will follow. You don't have to show up, just your feet. Because see, that's what I had to do. Now get back to the obsession of drink that wouldn't leave. The only thing that would make it go out of my mind was to take that serenity prayer and say it over and over and over again. And it seemed like the longer that I was sober, the harder it was to stay sober. This water must do something to me. I take a sip and I forget. So anyway, what was they at?
The longer it was, the safer.
Oh, very good. Did you all hear that? Okay. So I continued to turn around and stay sober by saying the serenity prayer. And when I was saying the serenity prayer, then the thinking about drinking wasn't there. But see, they would turn around and start saying things like, well, one guy turned around and told me early on in old time, he said, I probably spilt more of my tithe than you ever drank. I could have busted his lights out. I didn't. Oh, he was lucky. They'll leave a laugh there, huh? That doesn't mean that I'm not capable of it in sobriety. I'll tell you what, people don't call me Red. And you don't want to call me Red. We've got about 19 years of sobriety, and we're standing here, and I take him up by the collar, and I pull him out. You don't ever call me Red again. Oh, he was on, and he was probably shaking his boots. I thought it was very disrespectful, you know. But anyway, and the good thing about what happened after that, this man was able to come to me during the meeting. And he says, I'm really sorry that I said that. And I told him, I'm sorry that I tried to rough you up. And I meant it. I meant it. Because, see, I've learned to do it different in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. We have a design for living, and it comes out of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, when I first started working the steps, you know, I knew very little about one, other than the fact that it said in 12 and 12 that step one is a step that we take 100%. And, so I kind of jumped around because I didn't have anybody yet turning around and telling me how to work the steps. Of course, I wasn't going to ask. You know, people asked me how I was doing. I'd say, I'm fine. I was so fine, people left me alone in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm going to back up a little bit here. I learned to hate my father with a purple passion. He had hair growing here on his knuckles. And oh, I saw it on mine. The first thing I did is get a razor blade and cut that sucker off. Hate. Not dislike. Hate with a purple passion. And why did I hate him? Because he's not the ideal of a father that you would want to have. He was very abusive to me. And I was supposed to be his favorite. I'm telling you this to lead up to more about how the steps work. He had a business in Los Angeles. And I was probably a good 45 feet away from him, and I heard the phone ring. And after the phone rang, then he comes up to me and he says, why didn't you tell me? And my reply was, what? And then all of a sudden, pow, right into my mouth. Blood just coming down. I was riding a bicycle when I was younger, and I got probably a scar about 4 inches long and about a half inch wide where the bicycle pedal had didn't have the rubber on it, and I was riding it up a hill, and my leg slipped, and it gouged it. And I had too much fear to go turn around and tell him that I was hurt. And then I was to find out later that he molested me. My own father. And I asked my twin, I said, I don't remember anything like that. And she says, and my twin, she turned around and told me, she says, yes, Trish, it did happen to you because I saw it. So what I did was, when I got into the steps, I had to take steps 1 through 9 to be okay inside self about him. I'll tell you a little bit more, but I'm going to back up. What had happened as a result of working the steps, because I'm going to tell you more about the steps. As a result of working the steps, I was able to hold his hand with love and compassion. That's quite a difference. And that's how powerful these steps are. And the people turn around and talking about it's one of the tools that we can turn around and pick up. It's a tool to pick up, to turn around and take the journey inside me that I was never able to take when I drank. And the reason I talk about my drug log is because of Tradition 5. So one drunk will relate to the other. And I got caught quite a few times drunk driving. And when I got caught the last time, I was doing 95 miles an hour on the 405 freeway. Police officer pulled me over. And I knew how to cuss better than any sailor. I called him everything but sweetheart. Those handcuffs went on a little tighter. But I thank God that they didn't rough me out because I had a very foul mouth. And see, I was only expressing the only way that I knew how at the time. And I was kind of drunk that I was drunk in public, drunk in disorder. I got to the point to where I sit on a bus bench with a brown paper bag. The progression of disease, it gets worse. It's getting worse as I stand here. Because I've learned from people that was able to make it back into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. It got worse, it never got better. And I don't want to prove them wrong. And the reason I'm drinking water is because in 2013, I went to the doctor. I was diagnosed with a stage 3 cancer. Went back to the doctor, and I'm sorry, it's not stage 3, it's stage 4. And I thought, well, see, years back, I learned to build a relationship with God and have faith. And other people praying for me, including myself. And I was on the operating table for 4.5 hours. They took 14 lymph nodes from the side of my neck. I lost 45 pounds, and I didn't drink. See, that's what we do here. We build a foundation that's going to keep us from picking up the drink. And so, see, I have a foundation, and I still build on that foundation today. Because, see, I had to learn, just like I know I'm treating an alcoholic, what booze did to me. Here I am. I'm 15 years old. I wear t-shirts and khakis. I was in a place in Long Beach and I saw a maroon coupe drive by. That was my mother's car. And I went from Long Beach to Compton because that's where I was living, was Compton. And went to PE and I ran and I ran and I walked and I ran and I ran. I knew that I had to beat her home because the place that I was hanging out was a place where gay people were. And I made it home. And I went and grabbed a Coke out of the refrigerator. And I sat down and I began to drink it and act as if everything was okay. And my mother came up to me and she said, "Did I see you at the pizza place?" Yes, she did. And so my dad and mother was already divorced, so my mother's going to send me to my dad, the man that I hate, right? And they gave me two choices. They turned around and told me that I could go to an insane asylum or I could go with my father. I didn't know anything about an insane asylum, but I knew that I didn't want it. So I went and went to Oklahoma, because that's where he lived. Meanwhile, he wanted me to help him in the kitchen, and he says, I'm going to put the water, some chicken in a pan and some water, and I want you to watch it. Watch it? Burn up? But see, I have to go further back, because see, the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous turns around and tells us that we look at the wreckage of our past. It's in looking at the wreckage of my past that I have a future. So I had to go back a few years. I'm probably 16, 17 years old. And my mother says, Trish, would you help me with a salad? I says, of course. And all it was romaine. She'd already watched it and everything, and all she did was want me to just break it up. I began to break it up. And then my dad, he came up, and now I have a fear. It's an impending fear that I've worked on in my sobriety, but it has not left me completely. I go in the kitchen today, and if I help out, you want me to do carrots? That'll be fine. But you show me how long you want them, because I can't do anything wrong, because if you do something wrong, all that comes back on me. So, another reason why I hated my dad. Now, my mother was different. She was very loving and kind. She was a good woman all the years that she lived. She was glad to see me come into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. She turned around and told me, Trish, you don't know how many nights that I laid awake wondering when you would come home. Because, see, I'd go out there drinking, and I would just stay out there. And I was able to turn around and make my amends to her when she turned around and told me that. And I had no idea the hell that I had put her through. But I got a glimpse of it. And so with all kind of compassion, I turn around and I say, I'm sorry. And I have had a good relationship with my mother, you know, until she passed away. And I didn't really cry or mourn or do anything, because my relationship with her was right. And we were okay. I had nothing to be sad about. So, thanks for listening. I'm probably about 7 years sober. And I go to a meeting in San Gabriel, California. And it's a women's clothes meeting. Oh, I got dry mouth from the cancer. That's why I told you I was drinking water. But anyway. I went to this meeting in San Gabriel, the women's clothes meeting, and it just happened to be a book study meeting. And it was on step four. And that's when I got a lot of knowledge, and I've gained more knowledge over the steps, you know, throughout my sobriety. And if you do steps 1 through 9, what's going to happen is you'll never forget the incident. Like, I'll never forget what my dad did to me. But it isn't my dad that messes me up. It's the feelings that are connected to him that jack me up. And see, I had to see the powerlessness in step one. There's two parts to step one. I admitted I was an alcoholic, and that my life had become unmanageable. Now, turn around and talk about the powerless and unmanageability over the alcohol. I sober up and I have powerless and unmanageability in my life. Because I'm not willing to reach out, because there's too much fear inside myself. And I didn't know how I was going to turn around and tell you that I was fearful. But one day I came up with an idea. And I always wore white tennis shoes. And I turned around and told one or two people that if you see a scuff mark on my shoe, know that I'm not okay. That's the only way I knew how to tell. I needed help. And that was the beginning of turning around and taking the journey inside Trish. So we have all kinds of slogans on the wall back then that we do today. And they had one slogan that I didn't care for at all, and it said, think.
Yeah.
And that one I didn't care too much for because I would have to feel. And I don't know how to feel yet, but I'm working on feeling it, And in step two, it says, I came to believe in a power greater than myself to restore me to sanity. What that means is if I don't work the steps, I live a state of insanity. Hello, anybody home? So that's why they put these steps in the order. So you don't have to live in that powerlessness and insanity that is talked about in step two. And then step three, turn around, tells me in a prayer about the bondage itself. And some of the stuff that I described to you tonight was the bondage itself. And so what I was going to learn to do was to utilize step three. And my sponsor turned around and told me, she said, Trish, if you're doing step three, then it ain't none of your business. Because you're doing God's will, not your will. And I had my sponsor for 33 years before she passed away. And I loved her to death, still do. I went to go visit her at the VA. And I stayed in Long Beach for about 4 days. And the last day I saw her, she says, Trish, I want you to do me a favor. I said, what's that, morning? She says, I want you to get a sponsor because everybody needs a sponsor. So I turned around and promised her that I would get a sponsor. So I had to look around for a while for somebody that's got more time than I do. So I sold for somebody that's got 21 years of sobriety that has a good program. There's a mirror at the club that I used to go to in Long Beach, MWA, More Alumni Association, and a biblical mirror. And somebody was turning around and saying, if you have a problem, all you have to do is go look in that mirror. You don't have to look no further. It ain't your wife, it ain't your cop, it ain't your court, it ain't your kids. It's you. So that kind of opened the door. Maybe I need to change my thinking. And it did. Back to step three. When I before I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, well, let me describe it this way. The last time that I was in a drunk tank, I didn't want to live that way no more. When they hadn't found Alcoholics Anonymous yet. And so I didn't know nothing about AA. I hadn't been 12-step into AA yet. And so I've had some church throughout my whole life, and I do believe in God, and I know that I had to put him on the shelf when I drank, because I can't have both. Can't have both of them, to one or the other. And so I heard, and I think I might have read somewhere in the Bible about sin, you don't make any promises to God unless you keep them. So I really had to think about this promise that I was going to make. And so I thought about it for about 3 weeks. And I turned around and told God, I won't drink again if you keep me sober. So he's one of my vehicles that's turned around and helped me to take this brick wall that I've been able to take down brick by brick with your help, with my sponsor's help, and with God's help. Now, I had a hard understanding of what is the resentment? I looked it up in a couple of dictionaries, and I still had no clarity of what a resentment was. So, I'll tell you what they are. There's probably about three of them. And I'll give you an example first. My sister had four kids. Trish, would you babysit for me? The mind said no, but the mouth said yes. So I resented the fact that I couldn't turn around and tell her no. Resentment. Too high of expectations that I put on you or myself will lead to resentment. And resentments are a bunch of character defects that goes with it. And I call, there's a lot of, Big Book Turnaround talks about 100 forms of fear. And the people that I do inventory, sometimes I turn around and say, well, you know, just let's count these defects of character you have. Maybe they'll have, I have one that's probably had 78. Just because of one resentment. Because the 12 and 12 turnaround told us we have to look at the root of the cause. If we don't look at it all, we can't see a clear picture. And once we see the clear picture, then we can go the other way. And so here's what the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous asks us to do. And there's only one inventory as far as Trish is concerned. That comes out of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And what it asks us to do is look at who we resent. People, places, or things. So you write it down. Let's say I put my dad in there. I resent him. And you can have 5 resentments or 20 resentments against somebody. But what I learned to do is take them one at a time. I resent the fact that I got a ticket for speeding doesn't turn around and quite go along with me getting my drunk driving. They're two different things. They weigh different. But if I put them together, then I'm not going to see a clear picture. So if you've got a problem, mark it down on paper. Let's say you put down 15 things. Then only take one. One of those out of the 15, that problem, and you work on it, and if you work on it, you're no longer in the problem, you're in the solution. And the 4 chief character defects that I call them on resentment is, we end up with anger, fear, resentment, and self-pity. And under all that is a bunch of feelings. And if I don't take that journey inside self to see what those feelings are, I'm going to keep on doing it. I'm going to keep on doing it. But it asked me to go further. It turned around and asked me, what happened to my security as a result of having the resentment? I have no security. There's no security in resentment. And then it turned around and asked me to look at what happened to my ambition as a result of this resentment. Well, what happened, I became distant from my dad. I wouldn't call him. It wouldn't have anything to do with him. Because of the resentment, right? And then it turned around and asked us to write down the people or person that he was around while having this resentment. Because see, here I am, I'm sober, I'm on the freeway, I bought a brand new Z28 91. Here I am, it's hitting up the deal. Who's going to let a guy in his family do it and beat me? You know what I did? That foul mouth come back. I told him, I said, you MFCC and so forth, pull over. And you know what? The guy was smart enough not to pull over. But see, that was because of the unresolved stuff. I was a reactor of circumstances. That guy on the freeway had nothing to do with my resentment or the way I felt inside. So, I did make him amends. I don't know if he heard it or not, but I did make amends, you know, for doing that to that man. And I thought to myself, I'm glad that you didn't pull over. I wonder how long ago that was. That's pretty early in my stride when I pulled that one. And then when I started putting down the people that I was around, because when I have a resentment, I don't treat you right. I don't treat you right. And I'm going to have to make an amends for that, because I'm going to react to those circumstances. And who do I put on the top of that resentment list? Me. Nobody can do to me what I've done to myself. Nobody. You can turn around and tell me to get angry. It ain't going to work. So it's about uncover, discover, and discard. Big book, turn around and talk about putting the pen to paper. Because I can talk something, but if I write about it, it's in detail. And I can see more if it's in detail. Now I've got to muster up the courage, years ago, to turn around and talk to my sponsor. And I learned a valuable lesson about calling your sponsor. I had sister's husband had hit her on the shoulder with a pipe or something, some kind of object. And I rode motorcycles back then. I got on my, I was gone. I was probably doing 55 miles an hour in a residential area. I stopped at the gas station around this four cop cars there. I go up to him and I turn around and told him, if you do, you're dead. You touch her. A reactor of circumstances. And so what happened is, several months or so went by and her husband calls me and turned around and said, I'm going to kill your sister, I'm going to kill the kids. Yeah. And then I told him, you do what you have to do. He didn't do it. In order for me to take the journey inside self, I had to believe in a power greater myself, whatever you choose to call that power. I alone have never been able to do it. When I wrote my first inventory and I took it to my sponsor, I handed it to her, And she says, I says, here, you read it. She says, Trish, I'm sorry, but it don't work that way. You're going to read it. And I read it, and I wept. Because I had a lot of demoralization in it. Like the time they got thrown in jail, and I think this one was for a felony. My other felony is for carrying a .45 concealed weapon. So that's the kind of gal I used to be. And because I began to talk about that part about caring about myself, I went to the court and I had to pay some bucks, but I was able to have those felonies reduced to a misdemeanor, and they sealed them. And here I am, I'm wanting to grow in Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to do different than I've been doing. And I never was really good on English, verbs, adjectives, and all that stuff. And I went to school. This is after just about the time I quit working. And I went to school, and I took it again. I took it two times. And then I thought, well, you know what? I'm going to go to the library. I went to the library, and here I'm down at the bottom floor of the library, and I'm just this lady. I said, I want to learn about English, but I want to start out at the bottom. So I figured if I started out at the bottom, I'd be able to retain it more. Then I picked up a college dictionary on English. And so she said, you have to go upstairs to the kids' department. Okay, so I go upstairs there, and I turn around and tell her what I'm telling you, and she says, I'm sorry, but this is a kid's department. I said, no, it's for me. See, I learned how to smash my ego and my pride. It's about making changes. It's about being able to live inside myself. And these steps, in my opinion, have to be worked day in and day out, just like we do when we take a step 10. Or we look over our morning and we look over our evening and see if there's anything that we could have turned around and did different. My mind used to turn around and tell me, well, we'll just let it slide. And see, the more it slid, the more anger that controlled my life. I wasn't in control. The feelings are in control, just like the alcohol is in control. I'm not in control, they are. And one more time, I'm a reactor to circumstances. So anyway, I read this inventory to my sponsor, and we talked about it, and I was able to see some changes that I need to make in Trish. And then when we got down to the sixth step, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these steps of character, all these defects of character. Because see, if I do God's will, I'm not going to have any character defects. And seven, humbly ask him to remove my shortcomings. Now see, I've always asked questions along my sobriety because I want to find answers. And what I did, I went up to people that are old-timers and Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'll turn around and tell them, what's the difference in between six and seven? First one, six is about character defects. Seven is about shortcomings. What's the difference? Oh, Bob and Phil, they just wanted to add that to it to make 12 steps. All right. I must say the difference. You have to have a shortcoming before you can have a character defect. You just don't get character defects for nothing. You have to have a shortcoming. So they go hand in hand. Six and seven go hand in hand, just like eight and nine do. You know, 8 turn around and says make a list of all the persons who'd harmed. Making a list isn't enough because it calls for action. Making that list, making a mess. And then we turn around and get to 10. I touched on that a little bit about taking inventory. Please take them because here's what's going to happen. I have an invisible line here, and it's called serenity. And if I don't have serenity, I need to ask myself the question, why do I not have serenity? Because I'm doing something to mess that serenity up. It's an inside job. Look in that mirror and facing back to me. And sought through prayer and meditation, improve my conscious contact with God and understand Him. I have an excellent relationship with Christ. You know, I pray in the morning because I want to, because I'm a very thankful person. And I do meditate. And the one that is important is, it says, step 12. After having had the spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we try to carry the message to the alcoholic who still suffers. If you don't have the work and knowledge of the 12 steps, you're probably not carrying the message. You might be carrying the disease. Doesn't mean you can't work with somebody. Doesn't mean you can't help nobody. But see, I got to get the whole picture. If I'm going to go buy an automobile, I got to be sure that I can afford insurance. I can afford putting gas in it. You know, there's a lot of questions for me to ask. And I want to turn around and tell you that when they turn around and said, allow us to love you until you can learn to love yourself, I can say with all honesty that I love you. You know why I love you? Because I care about you. I want you to live. I want you to find the kind of life that I and others have found in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. You'd think after 37 years I wouldn't go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. They're all some that don't. But see, I learned some more valuable lessons for me. One, because I am an alcoholic, recovering alcoholic. Two is because I have to stay teachable. And three, that I can't get too smart for this program, that I don't think that I don't need it, or I don't need you. And if you please compare yourself to yourself, and you've already come a long ways, even if you got 5 days of sobriety. For you newcomers, I welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't think one day I'd be an old-timer in AA either. We start at the bottom, and we work up. So I hope that the journey that you're on will turn around and take you to walking on the sunny side of the street. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chris, for speaking tonight. The speaker will be available after the meeting. Good thing for speaking. Also, I thank you to anyone who has a commitment at this meeting. I'd like to give Chris another round. I'd like to thank our readers.